to approach Plato in order to become enlightened by him about Socrates, it has become customary to pay the greatest attention to certain dialogues called the early dialogues, and especially to the Apology of Socrates. The Apology of Socrates may be said to be Socrates' own account given on the most solemn occasion of his way of life, and its solemnity may be thought to be increased by the fact that that account is a public account, an account given in public to the public par excellence, whereas Socrates' own account of his way of life, which he gave on the day of his death in the Phaedo.
The drift of your meditation is correct, but your argument did not become fully clear to me. In a way, I believe you made one external mistake. You studied the whole law for this purpose. Now that, of course, you are perfectly free to do so, but considering the time required for preparing the meditation, that's too much. Maybe, did I tell you you should read the whole, you should? No. It is understood, I believe, that Mr. Gaya will give it a report next time on books 2 to 3.
That's right.
That's clear. So that we don't have to, well, my difficulty is this. You suggested that that Cicero is not simply a natural law teacher, but in your opinion, Cicero says a natural law is not true doctrine, but a politically salutary doctrine.
Yes.
Now that, and you gave some arguments. Now, but here you have to stop and say, well, if it is not true, why is it not true? And why is it not true according to Cicero?
Yes.
Now, the answer which you gave seemed to me that you tried to link up the denial of the theoretical truth of the natural law teaching with Cicero's preference for the theoretical life. That I understood. I mean, since that you made this assertion.
Yes.
But you did not make clear why this follows. Why can't you have both the supremacy of the theoretical life and the natural law?
Well, according to what I read of the natural law doctrine in the laws and in other books, the things I read that a man, well, first of all, the universal, the whole universe is a city, and every man must refer the whole to any part. He must have a concern with other people, with this a concern for his fellow man. The interest of
man. All right.
And also, he must refer the commonwealth to any single individual, and prefer the activity of the commonwealth to any single activity of any single individual.
Yeah, but all right, where is the difficulty here?
Well, yes.
Universal beneficence. And the beneficence is not limited to one federal citizens. It's the amount of the natural law.
And the interest in your fellow citizens here. I mean, there's a certain link with this. You have to be an activity involved here.
I see now what you're trying. That would not lead to denial of natural law. It would simply mean that the natural law, as it can be practiced by the citizen as citizen, is not the natural law in the full sense.
I think that is true. But it seems to me that,
in other words, only if the natural law must be a legitimation of civil society, as a particular society, and if there is an essential conflict between civil society as a particular society and universal philanthropy, would this follow?
Yeah.
I recognize now the parts of this argument in your.
I realize this wasn't a fundamental thing here. I mean, that I realize that it was possible that the Cicero thing could be dealt with the other. But I felt the doctrine is put forth in the laws, the book of the laws itself, did not admit of a theoretical thing, as Republic could.
Yeah, we must see that. I mean, I have some doubts as to whether you are right in this point. It was good of you to consider the nature of the gods and the on divination. I may mention in passing that Cicero's on the nature of gods became the model of Hume's dialogue concerning natural religion. I think we, your paper was good. There is some questions. Okay. Yeah.
Could I ask you what you just said about Hume? Was
no, Hume's dialogues are an imitation.
Imitation, yes.
Of Cicero's. So we follow. We will now try to follow the argument of the first book of the Laws and have recourse to the parallel passages. I mean, the chief parallel passages, as you will remember, are the third book of the Republic, where Laelius presents the natural law doctrine, but also this brief passage in the first book of the Republic, where Cicero speaks of that universal law with these implications regarding private property and so on, to which you referred. And how they are related, these three statements, is of course very important. Now, the Laws are a dialogue, as you have observed, and but a dialogue in which Cicero is the chief participant. And as that, I think, was the character of the Aristotelian dialogues, of which we have only fragments today. That, you know, in Plato, dialogue, Plato never appears as a character, never. He's only referred to twice, but he never appears. In Xenophon's dialogues, Xenophon appears all the time. Or he says, "I was present," yeah, when he said that, when Socrates said that. But Xenophon is never the chief character, of course. Socrates is the chief character. Now, in the Aristotelian dialogues, it seems Aristotle was the chief character, and that's the method which Cicero followed. It is an important question to which I do not have the answer, whether there, I think Mr. Kentrick raised it, yeah? Whether there is not some connection between Cicero's substantive philosophy. Were you the one?
And whose?
And?
Connection between his and whose.
And his? And?
You didn't complete your sentence?
Yeah. No, between Cicero's substantive thought and this method of presentation. Were you the one who raised this question?
Well,
it doesn't matter. It's certainly a reasonable question, regardless of whether you raised it or whoever else. Now, let us see. At the beginning, the first word of the dialogue is wood, lucus, meaning something dark. Yeah? And that has something to do with the fact, which comes out in other ways, a very hot day, and they seek the shade, whereas the Republic says saw the light. So that indicates from the very beginning that the theoretical level of the Laws is lower than that of the Republic. There is a reference to an old oak tree which Cicero had celebrated in a poem, Marius. Marius, a famous politician, general, statesman, who came from the same small town as Cicero came. And Cicero...
Yes. And that which was done with sensibility was done by sensibility. And that which was done senselessly by senselessness, he agreed. And that which is done in opposite ways is done by opposite. Yes. One thing is done by sensibility and quite another by senselessness. Yes. And in opposite ways, certainly. And therefore by opposites. Yes. Then senselessness is the opposite of sensibility. Clearly. And do remember that folly, that senselessness, has already been acknowledged by us to be the opposite of wisdom. He assented.
And he doesn't give Protagoras his answer because he's silent about him. Yes?
So, senselessness is the opposite of many things, not just one thing, but several things here. Is that what you're saying?
No, what he is trying to show is on the contrary, is that senselessness is the opposite of wisdom. Senselessness is the opposite of being sensible. But one thing, one opposite, can have only one other opposite.
Yes.
Hence, wisdom must be identical with sensibility. That's the argument. And we must first read this to the end. Yes?
And we said that everything has only one opposite. Yes. Then, Protagoras, which of the two assertions shall we renounce? One says that everything has but one opposite. The other, that wisdom is distinct from sensibility, and that both of them are parts of virtue, and that they are not only distinct, but dissimilar, both in themselves and in their powers, like the parts of a face. Which of these two assertions shall we renounce? For both of them together are certainly not in harmony. They do not accord or agree. For how can they be said to agree if everything can have only one opposite and not more than one? And yet senselessness, which is one, clearly has two opposites, wisdom and sensibility. Is not that true, Protagoras? What else would you say? He assented, but with great reluctance.
Yes.
Then sensibility and wisdom are the same. As before, justice and piety appear to us to be nearly the same.
So in other words, we have already made great headway, yeah? In improving the identity. Now let us consider that. The argument is very simple. There are two contradictory assumptions. First, that moderation or sensibility is different from wisdom, and the other, that one thing has only one opposite. Let us not go into any details, but what follows, assuming that this is a fair analysis of the situation, what follows from that when we have two contradictory assumptions? Yes.
Well, both can't be true, but of course either one can be true.
Uh-huh. And what does Socrates do?
Well, he just sort of assumes that, well, I mean, he says, what shall we give up? And then says, well, we'll give up the hypothesis that they're different.
In other words, yeah, Socrates picks arbitrarily one of the two. That he does very frequently. Yeah, and of course, either you are a nice man, then you have respect for Socrates' wisdom and say, it has to be. Or you are nasty or critical, then you want to have reasons from Socrates why he did it. And we must, that is the question. Protagoras' opposition was here, in this section, less marked than when we discussed piety and justice. The identification of wisdom and moderation is not as repulsive to him as the identification of justice and piety. Clearly, Protagoras is caught with the contradiction, and he is unable to extricate himself from it. Now this is of course of the utmost importance, because he who claims to teach virtue is shown to not to know what virtue is. He is compromised in the eyes of Hippocrates, because he may not won't understand any fallacy probably, but he sees whether this great personality is embarrassed or not embarrassed. Because no great no profundity of understanding is required for observing such things. Good. So Socrates has done quite a bit to prevent any harmful influence of Protagoras on Hippocrates. Mr. Schuster was first.
Well, pretty much everything, all the elements of the trap are ready before Socrates says, then we admit that something can only have one opposite, because the main part, he's already said that the senselessness is the opposite of being sensible, being moderate, and it's, but senselessness is also the opposite of wisdom. So that, I mean, Protagoras certainly must have seen what was
happening. Apparently not. That was not his forte. To foresee this kind of thing. Of course he could have very well have said this, what do you understand by, you don't make clear what you understand by moderation, so proceeding. I understand by moderation in the first place self-control regarding food, drink and sex. And I don't see any impossibility for a man being wise and at the same time lack sophrosyne. I mean, there are mathematicians or physicists or whatnot who are not outstanding in self-control in these matters. You see, he is, he after all, just as gorgeous in the gorgeous, he is under a kind of compulsion to give short answers in order to show that he is very good, not only at long speeches, but at short speeches as well. This is a comedy here, a part of the comedy here. Now, Mr. Ryan.
I'm still quite unhappy with Protagoras in not giving up the logical branch of the dilemma, the one opposite principle. I should think why does he lose less face by giving up on the thesis he was maintaining instead of this rash inductive assumption that he bit on?
You mean the regarding the only one opposite?
Yes.
Yeah, well, you must not forget, Protagoras is a man filled with his sense of importance. And this is a thing, especially if you have to do with a man who lacks it. Yeah. And therefore, you know, take a very big dog and a very small puppy who barks at him. He doesn't take that so very seriously, only when this small puppy, but a small dog, proves to be a very good fighter. That takes some time, perhaps, until it comes in. Now, similar situations arise among human beings. And therefore, Protagoras has not yet awakened to the situation. When he does, he will act and will hit back, as we will see soon. So, good. Now where are we now? Now we come to the next point.
And now, Protagoras, I said, we must finish the inquiry and not give up.
Yeah, let us not get tired, let us not get lazy. Yeah? But consider also the other thing, the remaining things, yes.
Do you think that an unjust man can be moderate?
No, yeah, can be sensitive. Can act sensibly. Yeah, he doesn't say, he uses the word anthropos, human being in general, not an anea, an hombre. So, making us wonder whether an hombre might very well act sensibly by being unjust, acting unjustly. You know, Caligula's time. But this is, of course, in a way. Elaborated. Yes. Good.
Do you think that an unjust person can be sensible in his injustice? I should be ashamed, Socrates, he said, to acknowledge this, which nevertheless many may be found to assert. And shall I argue with them or with you? I replied.
Yes.
I would rather, he said, that you should argue with the many first, if you will. It's no difference to me if you will only answer me and say...
Let us stop here for the moment. Now, Protagoras does not deny that injustice and moderation, as we call it, can go together. Nor does he assert it, you see, because that he is ashamed to say so does not necessarily mean that he doesn't think so. Now, Socrates this is very strange here. Socrates would, he puts a choice before Protagoras. Which thesis shall I discuss, you see? The thesis of the many, which says you can be just and moderate at the same, unjust and moderate at the same time, or Protagoras' shameful view, shamefaced view, that they cannot go together. Now, Socrates, we hear, would have questioned the thesis that justice and moderation are inseparable if Protagoras had asserted it. Yeah. against which of the two assertions shall I speak? Is it not extraordinary? So little is Socrates concerned with simply getting Protagoras to agree to his thesis of the unity of the virtues. His concern is rather with testing Protagoras. It can be done either way, and that in the immediate sequel.
And it makes no difference to me if you will only answer me and say whether you are of their opinion or not. My object is to test the validity of the argument, and yet the result may be that I who ask and the respondent will both be tested.
You see the delicacy of Socrates, and doesn't say I the who ask and you the respondent. He omits the you. He's extremely polite. So it's no longer the man that Protagoras identify himself with the logos, with the assertion to be examined, as he did in 331c. It is clear enough now where Protagoras stands on the present issue. Of course, it is clear that he thinks the two, you can be unjust while being sensible. I mean, only simple shame prevents him from saying so. Protagoras is again confronted with a choice here, as twice before. This time he seems to choose wisely, for by disagreeing with the common view, the popular view, he would concede defeat if he were to grant that justice and moderation are inseparable. He would just say, oh, Socrates is right, would he not? He must at least continue the fight. This is not clear. One point he was licked, clearly. In the other he was almost licked, the first. Now if he would now say, you cannot be just without being moderate, he would admit it in a third case. That would be the end of it. But he wishes to continue the fight because still some fight left in him. Now let us see.
Protagoras first played coy and said that the argument was not encouraging.
You see, his resistance now is greater than his resistance had ever been before. What is that issue to which he is so resistant? But
whether it's sensible to be unjust.
Yeah, now we get a more precise definition of that.
At length he consented to answer. Now then, I said, begin at the beginning and answer. You think that some men are sensible and yet unjust. Yes, he said, let that be admitted.
Yeah, all right. Because he will not identify himself with it, yes?
And sensibility is good sense. Yes, and good sense is good counsel in doing injustice. Granted, if they do well, I said, or if they do not do well, if they do well, and you would admit the existence of goods.
Oh, so there are some goods, yeah. Yes, now let us stop here a moment. Now what is the issue? The issue is whether one can do well by committing unjust acts. Well, if we use our own sense and use the word doing well in some common sense of the word, meaning getting rich, having a yacht, and all the other paraphernalia, by committing unjust acts, there is some evidence for that. In other words, this is a great problem of Callicles also in the Gorgias. Protagoras admits that being good at counseling may lead to injustice. But may I ask what he is doing to his pupils? He is teaching them good counsel, being well advised. Now if this is so, He is manifestly a teacher of injustice. Not necessarily only of injustice. In some cases he would advise, of course, justice, but also of injustice. And now, the good things with which he's being well advised and so is concerned, this belongs to the essence of moderation as he understood, and hence also of wisdom, because wisdom and moderation have been identified. A wise man, the loose sense of the word, is a man who can take care of his own interests by picking what is good for him and avoiding what is bad for him. If these considerations were absent in the discussion of justice and piety, this will come out later on, that is important. Now?
There are good things. Yes. And is the good that which is advantageous for man? Yes, by Zeus, he said.
Yeah. Now this is good that you bring out the oath, because that is a very rare occurrence in this dialogue. It is the first oath after the Hippocrates scene, where Hippocrates had sworn 5 times and Socrates 2. But in the whole, what happens is not a single oath. Now, when do people swear? And therefore, in particular, Protagoras swear. Pardon?
To emphasize.
Yeah, in a state of passion, true or feigned. Yeah. True or feigned, sure. Well, as we use the simplest example, that one doesn't use oaths in proving a mathematical theorem. But in political debate, oaths occur quite frequently. There are two opposite poles. Although Hobbes succeeded in swearing when he discovered Euclid, you remember the story? When Hobbes, as a man in the 40s, read Euclid in a bookstore, and then he saw a theorem which sounded, and it sounded very funny. And then he looked through the demonstration, and then he said, "My God, it is so." That was one of the rare cases where oaths were used in connection with you. This is indeed very funny. Good. And I have said this about you. Now, brothers, comes now passionate. All the things which have been building up all the time when this small dog had been barking at him and annoying him, now becomes, the moment has come where he must hit back. And this will come very soon. Yes?
And there are some things which may not be advantageous, and yet I call them good. I thought that Protagoras was getting ruffled and excited. He seemed to be marshalling his powers for a retort. Seeing this, I minded my business and gently said, "When you say, Protagoras, that things not advantageous are good..."
You see, Socrates acts very sensitive. The big dog is now becoming it's now becoming dangerous. Yes. Yes.
But things not advantageous are good. Do you mean not advantageous for man only, or not advantageous altogether? And do you call the latter good?
In other words, can you sensibly call something advantageous or useful which is not useful to anybody, to any being, man or no man? And then, Protagoras is now in his element again. Yes?
"Certainly not the last," he replied, "for I know of many things, meats, drinks, medicines, and 10,000 other things, which are not advantageous for man, and some which are advantageous, and some which are neither advantageous nor disadvantageous for man, but only for horses, and some for oxen only, and some for dogs, and some for no animals, but only for trees, and some for the roots..."
No, wait a moment. So up to this point, in other words, the useful differs in the, just as the species differ. Yeah, this is up to this point. That is perfectly reasonable. Dog food is not human food, etc. Yes.
And some for the roots of trees and not for their branches, as for example, manure. Which
now
is
here we, yeah, no, wait a moment. Here he goes within the species. That's the interesting thing. Something may be good because that is a part of the species in one sense, the root or the twigs. And the good things differ within the species. Now from here on one could go on to say that the good things differ from individuals of a species to the individuals. And in particular, that justice may be advantageous for some sorts of human beings and disadvantageous for others. The argument developed by Glaucon in the Second Book of the Republic and so on and so on. But this Protagoras will not do. He will not go to this length, as we will see. Yes. And now when he begins to speak of the dung.
Which is a good thing when laid about the roots of any plant, but utterly destructive if thrown upon the shoots and young branches. Or I may instance olive oil, which is mischievous to all plants, and generally most injurious to the hair of every animal, with the exception of man, but beneficial to human hair, and to the human body generally. And even in this application, so various and changeable is the nature of the benefit, that which is the greatest good to the exterior of the human body is a very great evil to its interior. And for this reason, physicians always forbid their patients the use of oil in their food, except in very small quantities, just enough to extinguish the disagreeable sensation of smell in meats and sauces.
Yes. Now, the main thesis is the good is multicolored, to translate literally. Multicolored. And that, of course, is in an obvious opposition to Plato, that the good is one, which he develops in the Republic. You have to go there, to such heights now. Let us consider some example. Dung. This most ill-smelling thing, this ugliest thing, ugly in the wider sense of the word, may be good. Now, but since the ugly has also the sense of morally ugly, the implication is clear. Oil, this adorning thing, may be bad. The noble may be bad. Ill-smelling things may be bad for the interior man, while they would be good for the exterior man, but the interior man is somehow more important. This is the end of the discussion, as we shall see soon, and we can say with definiteness one point, thanks to Protagoras' outbreak, he refuses now to say yes or no. He makes a long speech. The identity of justice and moderation has not been proven. And the whole question is still open. Good. But this, of course, we can say only by having read on for a few more lines, which I have done, and perhaps some of you. And we will now read on as soon as Mr. Reinke is ready.
When he had given this answer, the company cheered him.
Yeah, and praising him. So in other words, by one little move, Protagoras has completely recovered the whole lost ground. He didn't make too good a figure, he didn't cut too good a figure in these little question-answer things, but in the moment he was free to make a long speech, he won gloriously. Yes?
And I said, Protagoras, I have mentioned And when anyone makes a long speech to me, I never remember what he is talking about. As then, if I had been deaf and you were going to converse with
not
me...
Not quite deaf, but I have a feeling.
And you were going to converse with me, you would have had to raise your voice. So now, having such a bad memory, I will ask you to cut your answers shorter if you would take me with you.
You see, now, Sugata is corresponding to Protagoras' victory, that is Sugata's discomfiture. He is reduced now to appealing to Protagoras' compassion. Yeah? I am so inferior to you that you must have some compassion with me. Poor memory and poor hearing have, of course, something in common. They impoverish understanding in the double meaning of the term. Yeah? Good. Fine? Yes.
What do you mean, he said? How am I to shorten my answers?
Yeah, no, how do you command me to give brief answers?
How do you command me to give brief answers? Shall I make them too brief? Certainly not, I said. But brief enough? Yes, I said. Shall I answer what appears to me to be brief enough, or what appears to you to be brief enough?
You see, Protagoras is now sitting on high again, the high horse, and he resents Protagoras dictating to him, giving him commands. Sugata's in unjust conduct toward him. He does not say that Sugata is unjust in the Logos, commits crimes in the Logos, as Thrasymachus says, meaning that he makes logical errors and this kind of thing. He doesn't do that. For this would, then he would have to abandon all these sense of shame, all these reserves he had, and this is not opportune for him. But you see, he's now again perfectly in control of the situation. Yes. Now let us go on.
I have heard, I said, that you can speak and teach others to speak about the same things at such length, never seem to fail, or with such brevity that no one could use fewer of them. Please, therefore, if you talk with me, to adopt the latter or more compendious method.
Now, Suez appeals now no longer to Protagoras' compassion, that was hopeless, but to what Protagoras owes to his reputation. But he emphasizes this reputation. He says, I have heard. Formerly he had spoken of Protagoras' ability to give short answers as a fact. Now he speaks of it only as a rumor, because the ability to give short replies didn't prove to be so well founded. Yes. Good.
Socrates, he replied, many a battle of words have I fought, and if I had followed the method of disputation which my adversaries desired, as you want me to do, I should have been no better than another, and the name of Protagoras would not have spread all over Hellas.
So Protagoras owes his very reputation to the fact that he followed his own judgment, yeah, regarding short or long speeches. To his being well advised regarding his own affairs. In other words, to his sophrosyne, his moderation. That is the situation. Yes. Now, as therefore, is hopeless. A deadlock. Yes.
I saw that he was not satisfied with his previous answers, and that he would not play the part of answerer any more if he could help.
No, he would not answer any more voluntarily. Now, Protagoras will never again voluntarily answers Socrates' questions. He must be forced to do so, and this forcing will take place in the sequel. And this explains the situation, and this is an answer to a question which one of you raised before. This is the first time in Protagoras' life that he had made the wrong choices. That will never happen again. Good. Yes, now let us read the next speech and we must stop.
And I considered that there was no call upon me to continue the conversation. So I said, I do not wish to force the conversation upon you, if you had rather not. But when you are willing to argue with me in such a way that I can follow you, then I will argue with you. Now you, as is said of you by others, and as you say of yourself, are able to have discussions in shorter forms of speech as well as in longer, for you are a master of wisdom. But I cannot manage these long speeches. I only wish that I could. You, on the other hand, who are capable of either, ought to speak shorter as I beg you, and then we might converse. But I see that you are disinclined, and as I have an engagement which will prevent my staying to hear you at greater length, I have to be in another place, I will depart, although I should have liked to have heard you.
Yeah, that is... It's quite a speech. Now, yes. Socrates speaks of his reputation again, that he will be exposed as a charlatan if he doesn't give in. But this is not the main point of this speech, because he knows that it's no longer of any use to appeal to Protagoras. This speech is addressed to the others. To the others who might force Protagoras into doing what Socrates wants him to do. The situation is in this. By acting wisely, prudently, as we say, Protagoras acts unjustly. He disregards the common good, namely, that there should be a being together, a disputation. Now we see here, as you may have observed before, that what is going on in this intermezzo is a continuation of the interrupted discussion. The discussion of the relation of justice and moderation was interrupted. But this subject is now no longer discussed, but, so to speak, presented on the stage for our benefit. In this courtroom scene, as we can call it, we get here we get some clarity, some provisional clarity about justice. Justice means a decent respect for the opinion of others. The appeal to the compassion and the reputation of Protagoras was of no use. He is now trying to appeal to his respect for the opinion of others, for the interest of others, for the common good. And we must see what he comes out, and everyone present who is somebody will be drawn in order to bring about solution. Yes?
I think you have built up Socrates too much, because he's the one who can argue any proposition for the sake of getting enlightenment of Protagoras. He'd argue for the many, against the many, with Protagoras if he changed his mind, against Protagoras he'd argue under the earth and above the moon, anything to get Protagoras. No, that's not just either.
We will take this up, but the moral imputation implied, to which that point I would like to answer now in 1 or 2 minutes. I once wrote, when I had to write on these things, on such things, I said, Socrates can do with any interlocutor what he likes. And then a very learned man said, and said this is true of the sophists, not of Socrates. Whereupon I had to tell him that I had simply translated literally what Xenophon had said about Socrates. Socrates was a very clever dialectician. He was much more than that, but he was also very clever dialectician. I must have stopped.
Major, reason, power, mind, will, or any other term which may make my meaning clearer, that all nation, all nature is governed. For if you do not admit it, we must begin our argument with this problem before taking up anything else. Atticus, surely I will grant, if you insist upon it, the singing of the birds around about us and the babbling of the streams relieve me from all fear that I may be overheard by any of my comrades in the school.
Name is Epicurean. Yeah.
Marcus, that you must be careful, for it is their way to become very angry at times, as virtuous men will, and they will not tolerate your treason if they hear of it, to the opening passage of that excellent book in which the author has written, God troubles himself about nothing, neither his own concerns nor those of others.
And that's Epicurean, Epicurean himself. Yeah. You see, why does Atticus as an Epicurean creep in?
I can tell you why he gets on later on.
Mm-hmm.
The question of divination. They speak that they're quite concerned, the aristocrats, and they're quite concerned about the privileges given to the people.
Yeah.
And Cicero says that, I believe the third book, or second book, that the people were held down by these divinations or auspices, yeah, that this had an effect on the people. And I think that the only reason Atticus gives it in this case, which is tied into this other thing, is because of a political expediency.
Yeah, well, that is, can be assumed very on the basis of this. But Mr. Geyer will probably take this up and compare the two passages. Surely. In other words, Atticus is not only Epicurean, he is also a Roman citizen and belongs to the senatorial party. And from this point of view, he might very well accept what he philosophically rejects. It is clear. But Cicero himself changes the statement a bit. He speaks no longer of the highest reason, but of the nature, force, reason, power, etc., of the immortal gods. And that is an important change in the statement. The immortal, in other words, his first law is what the gods do or prescribe. And the question, of course, is which gods? Are these the cosmic gods, the stars or the movers of the whole, or Zeus, Jupiter and Apollo and the other gods? That makes a lot of a difference. But they are, and you see, if the natural law proper, what is now called prudence, is linked up with these gods, then the belief in these gods is the basis of the whole natural law. Yeah? That's the problem. Now we must see how this goes on. But we have already seen Cicero's qualifications before, you remember this, as it seems to me the case most of the time, as he said in paragraph 19, and obviously it's not always true. There is a certain theoretical effect of the natural law doctrine, and we have to find out what that effect is. What is not questioned is its politically salutary character. Yeah. And that's two different propositions. Now we turn to, Cicero himself turns now to this question in the next paragraph.
I will not make the argument that you will
read submission. That doesn't make any
sense. I will not make the argument wrong. Your admission leads us to this, that animal which we call man, endowed with foresight and quick intelligence, complex, keen, possessing memory, full of reason and prudence, has been given a certain distinguished status by the supreme God who created him. For he is the only one among so many different kinds and varieties of living beings who has a share in reason and thought, while all the rest are deprived of it. But what is more divine, I will not say in man only, but in all heaven and earth, then reason. What reason? And reason, when it is full grown and perfected, is rightly called wisdom. Therefore, since there is nothing better than reason, and since it exists both in man and God, the first common possession of man and God is reason. But those who have reason in common must also have right reason in common. And since right reason is law, we must believe that men have law also in common with the gods.
You see, he goes over from the one God to the gods, yeah? Yes.
Further, those who share law must also share justice.
Right, yeah. Yeah, because use, which he translates as justice, which we may do, is a special part of the law. The law of which he's speaking here refers to all good actions, whether they are actions of justice or actions of temperance or actions of courage. Doesn't make any difference. That is the distinction. Use, right, can be used synonymously with lex, with law. It can also mean a part, namely that which has to do with the relations of men to other men. Is this clear? I think it is not so clear in the English equivalent, therefore one has to stay there. In English you always say natural law, and then you say natural right, it has its very different meaning. Now, in the Roman language, use may be synonymous with lex. Yeah, it's very free. The right is a body of law. It may also refer to a special part of these legs of the universal law, namely to that which has to do with social relations. And then it is the virtue of justice is another sense. This ambiguity is not limited, it's not merely Roman, or for that matter Greek. You have also in English the wide meaning of right. Yeah? Where it means everything done right, or said right for that matter, correct? And also the narrow sense. Yeah, no, then you do not use it in English for the right in the narrower sense as related to human beings. But it's clear in German and in French.
Right,
would
that be in
the narrow sense? That is the thing which the classical writers never explicitly distinguished, but which you find distinguished, as far as I remember, in some later scholastic writers, namely that use in the meaning of the fundamentals, do they say, of subjective right. Now, this. Use means the body of law. For example, use can be told the body of laws and customs and of usages of the Helvetians. Yeah? Then use can also mean not the body of law, but the faculty, the legal faculty possessed by individuals under that law. For example, property right. Yeah? I have a right to do that. This is the Romans speak, for example, of use utendi ad abutendi, a right to use and misuse, which means here the right possessed by individuals. I distinguish it as follows. The right, there is a right which has man, possesses man. And then there is a right which is possessed by man. Because in the English legal language, the distinction is not so common. In continental language, they distinguish between law in the objective sense, right in the objective sense, and right in the subjective sense. Or is there a common law distinction corresponding to that? Yeah. At any rate, the rights of men are all subjective rights, rights possessed by individuals or by groups, you know, are not meant to be a body of law obliging. For ancient men, this was not so clear. When you say in Greek, Socrates is apology or something, Dikaios ami apologesis time, literally translated, I'm just in making a speech of defense. It is impossible to say whether Socrates fulfills a duty or exercises a right. I think if we would always use an expression which means either the one or the other. I'm entitled to make such speech, or I'm obliged to make such speech. In the Greek expression, you can't make a distinction. That goes back, and if I may make this point, because I believe it is some importance for the understanding of our notions also. Aristotle says somewhere in the Ethics, I do not remember where, at the moment, what the law does not enjoin, it forbids. What the law does not command, it forbids. That is hard for us to understand. We would say what the law does not command, it leaves us free to do it. For not only that is not Aristotle's private opinion, and that is not merely a Greek opinion, I believe you will find it everywhere in ancient societies. There is no sphere of life in which you can do what you please. You everywhere obey the law. And I remember a very otherwise good English commentator on the Ethics, Grant, makes this remark, well, what does this mean? For instance, the law never commands you to breathe, and therefore does the law forbid to breathe? That's of course simply nonsense. The law commands you to breathe, doesn't it, by indication? Is not true? How does it prove it? Prove it.
Prove that the law commands you to breathe. Mm-hmm. And what?
But it, for example, an example which is good enough for a man of your age, it commands you to be ready for military service when the country needs you. And therefore the law, in the broadly understood, expects you that you take care that you are fit bodily. Yeah? That is not a modern notion, but the older notion. And when a fortiori, it forbids you to commit suicide. So that is, it makes absolute sense, the older notion, but we have learned to take a much narrower view of law because of the concern with an autonomous private sphere, a concern wholly alien to earlier men. And that we must always keep in mind. The version, earlier men always understood even his acting on his right and his demanding his right as a fulfillment of duty. Mm-hmm. And the notion that rights come first and must then, as an afterthought, be limited by obligations in order to be preserved and safeguarded, that is a modern notion. Classically developed for the first time by Hobbes in some roundabout ways, by other people too, but that comes clear. Now, how did we come to this? Someone raised his finger while I made his long speech. Would you?
Very true.
Pardon? You retract? Yeah. Now, how? Yes. Now, go on where we left off. There are those among whom there is a communion of law. Among those, there is also a communion of right, in the sense of relation of justice. Yeah?
Those who share law and those who share justice.
Yeah, all right. Yeah.
And those who share these are to be regarded as members of the same commonwealth. If indeed they obey the same authorities and powers, this is true in a far greater degree. But as a matter of fact, they do obey this celestial system, the divine mind, and the God of transcendent power. Hence, we must now conceive this whole universe as one commonwealth of which both gods and men are members.
Yeah. Yes.
I have a question for you.
Yeah.
He distinguishes between reason and rightness.
Yeah. So that he makes clear later on. But you can say that in these cases here he's speaking of reason as right reason. Right reason is a perfected reason. It's a cultivated reason. When he makes a distinction. I think that occurs somewhere, doesn't it?
No, he calls reason, but it's still about the perfected wisdom.
Yeah, but there is later on a passage, I think in the first book we probably find it, in which he makes an explicit distinction between reason and right reason. Right reason is reason perfected, or at any rate not corrupted. In this way, how do you understand the distinction, Father Bhakti?
There isn't something similar to the tonistic distinction between speculative and practical?
No, no, it's surely nothing.
Right reason, practical reason, and...
No, that... I mean, I would never settle this question by swearing, yeah, by Zeus, but in this case, I'm inclined to say by Zeus. you know, check on me, but I believe you will come out with some misunderstanding.
The right reason means the individual human reason in accord with the objective order established by natural law. In other words, not reason. I think it acknowledges the possibility of reason coming to a wrong conclusion, you know, about practical things.
Yeah.
And he's not speaking about any operation of reason, but a reason that is in accord with this objective order set up according to the nature of man, the nature of God.
Yeah, no, well, then in other words, I was right in what I said. Yeah. I mean, the reason actualized, perfected, is right reason. Yes, I think it has nothing whatever to do with the distinction between theoretical practice.
In what sense, though, is reason common to God and man? And therefore, right reason is also common.
That is here merely asserted. But that is here merely asserted, and the difficulties which Cicero has are of course connected with this very problem. But still we can understand the assertion. If there is a cosmic order, yeah, if there is a rationality in the whole, must there not also be a mind perceiving this reason or embodying this reason? I believe it is along these lines. That's a very long story. It has very much to do with the question of motion, the first mover. Must the first mover of an ordered whole not have an understanding of that ordered whole? Must there not be a reason? Something of this kind, I believe, is the argument.
Well, I was thinking also of the only problem of the distinctions between reason and right reason and man, between actuality and potentiality.
No, that would not, I mean, but I would, I think the implication is that the possibility of a corruption of reason exists only in the sublunar beings, in man.
But I'm sorry.
That the possibility of a corruption of reason exists only in the sublunar beings, in the earthly beings, men.
I was going to say that this is something you have to assert.
Yeah, sure. Oh, well. This is, after all, a popular statement. We must try to see, try to find out what the reasons were which induced Cicero to present this doctrine as politically salutary but otherwise theoretically doubtful. And that is probably one of the points. At any rate, in The Nature of the Gods, where he attacks the Stoic teleological theology, that is the base of that. And he says he prefers it to the Epicurean doctrine or any materialistic doctrine and mechanical doctrine, but it is not sufficiently supported to build on it. Now, and therefore, the great question arises, what is the status of the moral doctrine of Cicero? If it is not based, if it cannot be based, on this kind of cosmology. This cosmology would justify Cicero's morality. But whether this cosmology is true or not remains one of the questions. That is, I think, the state.
Well, I was going to say you'd have to convince me also that he presents this merely as salutary and state.
Yeah, but look, he indicates a certain doubt. Yeah? He indicates a certain doubt. It seems to him true most of the time, as you put it. And
he is at the same time and in the same act most self-forgetting. Since spirit is undetermined as to the primary end, the good of the body or the good of the mind, it is in a way in